Hi everybody and welcome to yet another research seminar by the Hellenic Observatory.
Sound like an endurance test. Yet another seminar.
Yet another, because we offer so many. And so thanks for coming everybody. It is a pleasure to welcome our speaker for this seminar. Philip Katsinas is a long-term friend and collaborator of the Hellenic Observatory. He is currently visiting fellow at the Hellenic Observatory, but he's been for a number of years, postdoc fellow research officer with us. Philip holds a PhD in geography from King's College, across the street, somewhere. His work focuses broadly on the transformations of housing systems, including the social and spatial impacts of the increasing role of finance and tourism on urban economies. Among his other affiliations, he has teaching roles in King's College and Birkbeck, and he is part of the City Collective of the General City. His publications include, actually focus a lot on the wonderful city of Thessaloniki, including a recent paper in Environment Planning A on the professionalization of short-term rentals and emerging tourism certification in post-crisis Thessaloniki. And other work in area and elsewhere, including also more policy, public-based work. I'm referring to his recent publication with Dimitris Souvias at the Institute for Alternative Policies in Athens on political imaginary of happiness in Greece. So his work touches upon, aspects of urban sociology as well as urban economic organization. I will let him explain better to us. His work on the privatization of public space by leisure industries and commercial gentrification in post-pandemic Greece. We're going to allow Philip the usual 45 minutes for his presentation, and then we're going to open it up to discussion and questions. But I think, if Philip, you're happy, if there is a burning question about, you know, a clarification point that you want to ask, feel free to interrupt him ask him. Okay. Thanks, Philip.
Well, thank you very much for having me here, and thank you, Vasilis, for the introduction. As Vasilis said, and as you can see on the screen, I'm going to talk about Thessaloniki, the city of Thessaloniki. This, you might recognize this photo, although it's probably more than a decade old, but the city hasn't changed too much since then. So I will argue that the commodification and privatization of public space are key factors influencing gentrification and touristification. Now, these are all very key terms if you're focusing on urban sociology, urban geography, urban studies more generally. So I'm not sure how many of you are very familiar with these. I'm trying to keep this rather simple tonight. So, as I said, focusing on privatization and commodification of public space in influencing processes of gentrification, diversification, and how this privatization of public space contributes to the construction, to the building of a rent gap, which I'm also going to explain. So I'm going to talk a bit about rent gap theory. So I will focus on the examples of the uses of public space by leisure industries. So by private commercial space, turning it into private commercial space in the city center of Thessaloniki, looking at the interaction of these leisure industries with state actors and with the landlords of these premises. Now, as you're all very much aware, in the previous decade, tourism, leisure, and entertainment were adopted as key strategies for overcoming the economic crisis in most of the southern European region and in major cities in southern European cities. The cities tried to market their heritage, their vibrant nightlife, their outdoors coffee culture, and as a result, they were impacted by gentrification, by tourism development, by touristification. Also due to the proliferation of short-term rentals, which became a major issue during the last decade, and of course also lifestyle migration, especially in cities like Barcelona. Now, while commercial gentrification is often seen as a phenomenon to residential gentrification, it has increasingly attracted interest in urban studies, scholarly attention, and leisure industries, so restaurants, bars, coffee shops, and so on, have been analyzed as changing the atmosphere of areas, attracting middle classes, investors, and tourists, but also contributing to nuisances such as noise pollution, such as antisocial behavior, which as a result, all of these then create displacement pressures to local residents, to local professionals, and other users of space. Such pressures and nuisances have been intensified after the pandemic, especially because a lot of state actors encouraged the further privatization and encroachment of public space. So this is an example of London, again from the same publication, also, no, that's the Observer. Okay, so the same publishing company, let's say. We can see in this report that they were also mentioning the opinions of local inhabitants about being stressed from the extra noise pollution and antisocial behavior that was caused by the additional amount of leisure industries operating in public. This is another publication, another article from the same media group, from The Guardian this time. This is a few months after this publication here in The Observer, which was in August 2021. But here, we don't see any concerns of that kind. So we don't really care about the locals as long as it's far away, I guess. Could be a message here. This is a typical article like the one from 2015 that I showed before. Acting as a tourism marketing publication. So cities like Thessaloniki continue to be seen as holiday destinations, as city break destinations for a weekend, because of the food and drink that they can offer, of their vibrant nightlife, as you can see here in this photograph from Ladavica district in Thessaloniki. So anyway, as I said, we will focus on the privatization and commodification of public space as a key factor for the growth of leisure industries and for gentrification and touristification. Now, I've mentioned these Asians, patients, whatever you want to call these nouns, a lot of times already, so let me just give you some short definitions of how I use these concepts. Now, privatization and commodification are terms which are widely used in geography, and political economy, and urban studies, and they are largely interconnected. So following Neil Smith and Seth Lowe, we could say that privatization is the transfer of publicly owned or publicly operated land, assets, and so on, space as well, to private ownership or operation. And commodification is the subordination of the public use of land, assets, or space, if you wish, to its economic value, which is something that Matthias Berndt would argue. Well, in terms of gentrification, I understand it in a very, very general, broad way, following this broad definition provided by Eric Clark, who's arguing that gentrification is a process involving a change in the population of land users, such that the new users are of higher socioeconomic status than the previous users, together with an associated change in the built environment through a reinvestment in fixed capital. So very central then to this definition here is a change in the population of land users. He's talking about land users, not just about residents. So this has to do with displacement or replacement of particular populations by other populations. And the second important indicator there is the investment or reinvestment of capital. Now, touristification is a term which has many times been used as identical to gentrification. There's a huge debate in urban studies about the relationship between these two concepts. Some authors like Agustin Coco-Lacan would argue that tourism is a key driving force of gentrification. It's contributing to the widening of rent gaps, and it's leading to reinvestment of capital, causing the displacement of less affluent residents and professionals, both of lower income residents and shops which cater their needs in cities. Other people, like Sequeira and Nofre, for instance, would argue that gentrification and touristification do not have much to do with each other, because touristification would lead to cross-class displacement in cities, and also the depopulation, because the nuisances which are caused by tourism also drive away the richer people who live in city centers or in other parts of the city which are desirable to tourists. In practice, though, as ongoing research in urban studies is showing, it's very difficult to decouple these two concepts, these two processes, and they tend to happen concurrently. So I'm using them here as happening concurrently as well. Yes, Gary?
Sorry, Philip, can I just clarify? It's fascinating stuff. Is the combination between tourism and gentrification the concept of touristification?
For some people working with these concepts, it is the combination of the two. For others, it's a similar process, but it's not identical to gentrification because it doesn't just lead to the replacement of people of low socioeconomic status, but also of high socioeconomic status. So this is would be a main difference there for those people. But in practice, we could say that both processes take place at the same time, especially as analyzed in cities in Southern Europe, like Venice or like Barcelona, even Athens and Thessaloniki. Is that okay? So I also already mentioned the concept of red gap, so red gap theory, which is very, very central in gentrification studies. This concept, the red gap, was formulated by Neil Smith, and it is generally used to explain the susceptibility of land to reinvestment or investment of capital when the actual ground rent of a plot under its current use is lower than the potential use of this land or this building, this property, under its higher and better or highest and best use. Now, I'm going to disentangle this a bit more in a second. So this rent gap theory is obviously not an all-explanatory variable for urban processes, but it's used to illustrate the economic incentives behind reinvestment of capital without predicting how and when gentrification is actually going to happen and when areas are going to be redeveloped. Obviously, there are several factors which could influence the reinvestment of capital, which could include the preferences of small or large-scale investors, the preferences of gentrifiers, so people who want to move themselves into an area, but also the reputation that specific areas have. If they're territorially stigmatized, for instance, it's harder for these areas to see any larger-scale investments going into them. Now, if we look at this figure here, if we look at this vertical axis here on the left, this has to do with the value of a construction or a building, or even of land. So when something is built on this land, a construction, it has a certain value, which is relatively high because it was just newly built. Now, this horizontal axis is the time. As time passes, the value of this construction will start decreasing because of the deterioration that's happening to the building, because of the costs required for its maintenance, because of the ongoing uses, and so on. Also because of technological advances which would make other buildings more desirable. So it's logical that over time, the value of a construction starts to deteriorate. Now for this construction, this may be a house, this may be a hotel, this would be a commercial building, or a mixture of these, there is a specific land rent that can be charged. So this would be the capitalized land rent, or ground rent, as I would say, which also starts somewhere. And for a number of years, if this building is located in an area which is desirable, because it's also newly built, this land rent is going to be increasing for this building. But as the quality of the building starts deteriorating, as other areas might also become more desirable, as other buildings might become more desirable, it's obvious that at some point, the value of this building, of the land rent that can be charged for this building or apartment or so on, will start decreasing. The idea here is that if we changed the use of this building through reinvestment or not, there could be potentially an increased land rent that could be charged. Mm. So this could be the line showing the potential land rent. So there's a difference then between the current land rent, which can be asked for under the current use, and the potential rent that would be possible if we changed the land use there. This could happen, as I said, because of reinvestment in the building, because of demolition of the building and the construction of a new building, for a variety of reasons. Now, these two concepts, so capitalized land rent and potential land rent, are rather difficult to measure in practice. They're usually measured by using some proxies, which could include sales prices of buildings or apartments, or rentals, the amount of rentals that are charged for these. So we could, for instance, compare the rental before redevelopment and after redevelopment to be able to calculate the difference between the current land rent and the potential land rent under changed use. Overall, it could be argued that increased capitalized land rent reflects improvements which have been made to a building or property through renovation or for the construction of a new building, and also changes that have been made to the surrounding area. So it's not just the building itself that makes up the value of the construction, but also the reputation of the area where in which it is located. These are neighborhood effects, such as urban regeneration or the symbolic transformation of an area. So in other words, the land rent, the ground rent, is a composite of both the building rent and the rent of the neighborhood, so the ground rent of the neighborhood. These two concepts are also hardly disentangled in practice, so we normally consider them together. Now, this is exactly the point where my argument comes in, which has to do with the impact of public space or the use of public space, the privatization of public space. Now, I argue that in addition to building and ground rent, the possibility of using public space for private interests also contributes to the level of ground rent, and this is specifically the case with leisure industries, which are normally located on ground floors of buildings. So leisure industries may be able to annex public space for their operation, depending on the degree to which the commodification of land, of public space, is permitted in a specific society. Therefore, the capitalized ground rent for leisure industries also reflects the degree of commodification of public space. So the degree to which public space can be functionally added to a property, can be privatized, can be commodified. Is that okay? Okay? So in cities in Southern Europe that rely a lot...
Since you asked, can I ask a question? But I mean, so I fully, you know, understand and believe, you know, I accept that capitalized ground rent for leisure industries reflects the degree of the commodification of public space.
Yeah.
But isn't this something that, is this, I mean, to what degree is this not something which is kind of established in the sense that if you put it in a different language, you would say, okay, you know, if I transfer property rights to somebody to, you know, put tables in front of River Thames, that's going to increase the value of the property because there's going to be a commercial value in the activity that I license. So are you saying something different from my example?
Not at all. It seems very obvious to me as well. It's just that in urban studies and in gentrification theory, it's something that has not been taken into account when using this theory, using this gentrification or rent cap theory. It's never been taken into account in practice. I don't know of any examples where this has happened. So it's a small, maybe self-evident contribution, but it's still something that hasn't been written about before in this field. So, as I said, in cities in Southern Europe that rely on tourism and consumption, and specifically in Thessaloniki, leisure industries are often a higher and better use for buildings or for the ground floors of buildings. In city centers and other parts of cities which have a tourism interest. And the question then is how to measure this contribution of the privatization and commodification of public space to the proliferation of leisure industries. Now, usually, as I said, one would compare the level of rents before and after redevelopment to see the difference between them, and this would be kind of the rent gap. Now, the problem is that in the case of Thessaloniki in Greece more generally, and especially for commercial rents, these data are unavailable or very, very hard to access. I could try to do this by analyzing data of major websites, for instance, listing commercial properties, but there are several difficulties about seeing which of these properties would be on ground floors, which of these commercial properties would be for leisure industries or not. There is also a second limitation, which is a theoretical one and more important, which has to do with assessing the contribution of commodification of public space to rent in any case. If it is already difficult to disentangle building to ground rent, from ground rent, so between the two, how could we then disentangle public space rent from the other two as well? So instead, I'm using qualitative interviews for my research with a range of actors. I interviewed local residents and professionals, commercial tenants and landlords, real estate agents, members of the local government, and other municipal councillors, but also members of citizen initiatives, to see if this public space rent, as I call it here, can be measured in any way and if it really exists. Now, before doing this, I want to go a step back now and just talk a bit about the proliferation of leisure industries in the Greek context. So cafe culture, coffee culture became a very, very dominant form of sociability based on purchasing, based on consuming in the post-Second World War period in Greece. Especially in the 1980s, the expansion of middle classes enhanced demand for leisure industries in cities like Thessaloniki. And this was mainly covered by micro-entrepreneurs. So large numbers of bars, restaurants, cafes were opened by people from various backgrounds, usually with limited financial resources, and the use of sweat equity. So they invested their own work into developing, into opening the shops. This included people from working class backgrounds, lower middle class backgrounds, who were breaking with parental or with personal occupations due to limited career prospects that they might have had, but also middle class professionals, maybe artists, small retailers. And as a result, the number of these leisure industries really exploded in the 1980s, 1990s in Greek cities. And this also played a key role in the redevelopment of inner city areas, which were previously characterized by abandonment, by heritage building, which had become unused, by low real estate prices. So this led, in the case of Thessaloniki, to the redevelopment of areas like Ladavika, some of you might know, or the Frankish Quarter. Of course, then more established entrepreneurs followed, and also some national and multinational chains and franchises. But in general, we can say that speculative strategies of different categories of entrepreneurs and the hyper-concentration of leisure industries often resulted in the decline of such clusters. The economic crisis and the contraction of the Greek economy also played a key role and had an impact on leisure industries. But the sector was one of the few to recover in Greece, given its labor-intensive character and also the precarious working conditions, but also owing to the tourism growth strategy of a city like Thessaloniki. So here we can see the development of leisure industries since 2014. This is this black line here. We can see that they increased slightly but steadily over this period of time until 2019. And then, of course, because of the pandemic, they started declining again. At the same time, the total number of closed ground floor businesses, shops, in the city center, so in the same area, increased drastically. It increased by 30%. So while leisure industries increased slightly, also the number of closed shops increased drastically at the same time. So leisure industries were one of the few sectors which more or less remained stable in the city. All other commercial activities declined over the same period of time. Now, public space in the Greek context is managed by the municipal governments, by local governments, within their administrative borders, with the goal of preserving public and open access and use. This is according to law 3463 of 2006. According to the civil code, which precedes this law, but they're both valid at the same time, special private rights may be acquired to common things with the concession of the authority under the terms of the law, as long as these rights serve or do not negate the common use. So in both of these legal documents, we have reference to public use, common use. These are, of course, very, very vague concepts. There's no specialization of what exactly open or common use really entails of public space. So municipalities are allowed to rent parts of public space, sidewalks, of pedestrian streets, squares, and other public spaces to private actors. And this has a logic that it needs to be done legally, because it has to do with the social legal technology of licensing, of providing licenses to regulate and manage different activities, a range of different activities, which are taking place on public space, setting specific conditions for the use of public space. As I said, in theory, private activities, so the privatization of public space, should not limit the common use of public space. And some limits to the proportion of public space that can be privatized exist legally. For instance, according to a ministerial decision of 2009, a right-of-way of a width of 1.5 meters exists on sidewalks, so this has to be unblocked at all times. And on pedestrian streets, 3.5 meters need to be open and accessible to everyone at all times. They must be barrier-free. Well, already with this photograph, we can see that this 1.5 meter is not really there in practice, but I'm coming back to this point. So we have these limits that exist. There are some limits to the privatization of public space, but as the Greek ombudsman already argued back in 2006, due to the excessive number of licenses that have been granted to leisure industries around the country, the common use of public space is often negated in practice. So while licenses may be used for several different activities which are taking place in public space, this could include street performance, street vending, up to sidewalk cafes, it is the last mentioned, given their proliferation around the city, that raised the main concern regarding public space privatization. This is another example of La Radica. So you see that the whole square is occupied by tables and chairs of leisure industries. And of course, any financial transactions that are required in privatized public space, for instance, for sitting, just sitting inside a cafe, lead to the exclusion of other activities and of people who are unwilling or unable to consume or pay. We could thus argue that a very high degree of commodification of public space exists in Thessaloniki, but also in Greece more generally. Now, in practice then, a municipality can rent out parts of public space to private entrepreneurs, of course, as long as there are no restrictions. And municipalities like the one of Thessaloniki have price lists for the rental of public space, like this one that you can see here. I have to apologize that this is only in Greek. There was no English version available. But I'll try to translate the important parts. So this is about the occupation of public space by tables and chairs of leisure industries. So the municipality of Thessaloniki is distinguishing between four different zones. We're only interested in this first zone, which is about public space in the city center of the city. And we see that on sidewalks, which are within these streets here, which I'm not going to mention, leisure industries have to pay 123 euros per square meter per year for the rental of public space. In some streets of this zone, like the seafront street of Leoforos Nikis, this is much higher. This would be 303 euros per square meter per year for a leisure industry to privatize. There's other charges for squares, other charges for pedestrian streets, which are higher than the 123, so usually about 200 euros per square meter per year. But obviously, this is a good income for a local government. And it also provides an incentive then to rent out public space to leisure industries. Now, if we look at the total income of the municipality, the income that it gets just from renting out public space is about 1% of its total revenue, its total income. It is certainly a good sum, I would say, but it is not a significant income that the municipality would not be able to go without. So they could, in practice, if they wanted, to reduce the amount of public space that is rented out to leisure industries.
It seems to be quite cheap. I know this is sort of leaky, but nevertheless, it seems to be quite
it's not cheap.
Sorry?
A beach costs 3,000 euros.
Yeah. So
that's it.
But is the impression that it's relatively stable, these fees?
Yes, they have been stable since 2018 now.
Right. And would we assume that that's partly because of not wanting to upset voters?
It is definitely one of the incentives, and this is actually a very good comment because I haven't looked into other places and what they charge. It would be interesting to see what other cities in other countries as well charge there. So, thank you. But it is relatively cheap if you consider the amount that a leisure industry can make in income over that year from this one square meter. Now, as I said, this provides them an incentive to local governments to rent out as much public space as they can to increase their profit. So this is usually done through urban regeneration interventions, through trying to upgrade sidewalks, for instance, widening sidewalks, creating pedestrian streets, creating new squares, and thus facilitating the expansion of leisure industries and other related tourism-related businesses. This often is done under the pretext of increased livability in the city centre and the banning of cars from it, but in practice it usually results in the privatisation of this public space. So this is an example I'm going to go quickly through. This is from the Frankish Quarter in Thessaloniki. This is a place which in the past was used as a car park. Now in 2014, the local government enclosed this and wanted to turn it into a square. So this photo is from 2013, before the redevelopment happened. This is from 2016, after the formation of the square. And you can also already see some tables and chairs from this. Restaurants trying to get into the square. And this photo is from this year, from 2022. It's from a different perspective, but the chair is now fully occupied by the tables and chairs. Of course, it also has to do with COVID and the measures by the state government into aiming to help leisure industries by giving them extra private space, but we can see that the whole of the public space has been privatized de facto.
When you take the pictures very early in the morning, or was it a slow day?
These are restaurants, tavernas.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't think that till late in the afternoon, judging from the Greeks, there's too much going on there. Yeah. But, yeah, this and this one were taken in September, I think. So, September 2016 and September 2022. Yeah. So these urban regeneration interventions like this create additional public space, but as I said, this public space is mainly created to be privatized. This is something that is happening a lot through interventions financed by the EU and by national funds, and mainly benefit property owners and entrepreneurs in the specific areas and in some of the adjacent areas and streets. And as Vasilis Arapoglou with his colleagues argue in a paper that was recently published here by the Greece Working Paper Series of the HO, such interventions in the Greek context mainly constitute an indirect subsidy for the Greek leisure and entertainment sector. There are no wider benefits for other local residents and other professionals there. So if we want to return to the rent cap then, we could say that in these regenerated areas, like it is in the Frankish Quarter, rents increased significantly after interventions. There, for instance, they went up by 100 to 200%, as both leisure professionals told me, but also real estate agents. So urban regeneration, obviously, into changes in land uses, the opening of more leisure industries, has an impact on rents. This is clear there. But the question then is, how much of this has to do with the public space? Can it just be because of the additional value that was created because of the urban regeneration, because of the upgrade of the physical infrastructure? Or does the possibility of occupying public space also play a role there? So it is hard to disentangle this. So I try to do this by focusing on some specific examples.
Philip, 10 minutes.
Yeah. So here you can see the floor plan of a cafe in the city center of Thessaloniki. As you can see, the shop is 29 and a half square meters in size only, so it's a quite small shop. Of these 29 and a half square meters, 16.52 square meters are used for tables and chairs inside the shop. And then the shop also has a license to occupy space outside, so these chairs and tables here, here, and there, which have a total size of 20.40 square meters. So basically, the space that this cafe occupies on public space for tables and chairs is larger than the space that it has available indoors. If this was any other commercial use, they would not be able to use this outside space. If it was a clothing store, for instance, they would not be able to get a license for it. So there's already a hint there that public space influences this. Then I, of course, also conducted interviews with leisure professionals and real estate agents who point to that same direction. I have a quote here, which is very interesting. This is by a bar owner in a pedestrianized street who argues that in his bar, he only has enough space inside the bar for a bar counter, but he has 15 tables outside. So most of his revenue comes from these tables which are located outside. Now he argues that if the owner was renting this to some other kind of shop, there is no way that they would be able to charge the rent that I'm paying. So it becomes very, very apparent here that the possibility of exploiting additional space provides incentives to both landlords and to tenants. So property owners, commercial landlords, will prefer to rent to commercial tenants, which are used in leisure industries, because they can charge higher rents. And leisure industry professionals obviously will also try to locate to areas where they can use public space, so where the privatization of public space is possible. We can thus say that the privatization of public space contributes to the creation or to the widening of rent gaps and to shifting the highest and best uses of commercial ground floor properties in cities, especially in cities that attract tourism and consumption. And the incentive to maximize rents and the number of clients leads to attempts to use any means to maximize the use of public space for leisure industries. These here are some examples of situations in which public space is illegally occupied again. Again, from the city center of Thessaloniki. So we can see this leather industry is not following the limits that have been set about the 1.5 or 2 meters that needs to be available for pedestrians on sidewalks, for instance. And this is a practice that is at least tolerated by the local government, which often states that it does not have the means or the legal tools or the number of enforcers to enforce any restrictions. This is something that we would say that it reflects structural characteristics of the Greek planning system, which is more or less characterized by tolerance of illegal construction throughout the decades and public land dispossession, and assuring clientelistic political support for its beneficiaries. Like, there's a lot that has been written about this by people like Hadzi Michalis in the Greek context, for instance. Now, the municipal police, which is the city agency which is charged with enforcing access to public space, it does not conduct regular inspections, claiming that it lacks sufficient staff. Its approach to public space enforcement is mainly complaint-driven, responding to complaints that have been made by members of the public. And even then, inspections are rarely made. And if inspections take place, like the one here, these are usually made by turning them into media stands, so by bringing in all of the local media, which are then allowed to take photos, like this one here. You can see the watermark of the website on which this photo was published, so to show that the local government is doing something against the illegal occupation of public space. Moreover, the leisure industries themselves seem largely unfazed by the possibility of being discovered or being punished, as fines for violations are relatively low, and the process of temporarily or even permanently revoking the right to occupy public space or even the license to operate a shop requires repeated violation and is something that is easily circumvented. So fines are usually paid right away because, as many leisure industries state, they can afford to pay these fines given the additional income that they can make through this illegal activity. In some cases, some professionals would ignore the fines, and in cases of repeated violations, as I said, this is easily circumvented under the current legal framework. Owners, for instance, might just change the name of the legal representative of the business, and as it runs under another person, they have to start anew for all of the violations. So the local government is very much proactive in the commercial exploitation of public space. As I said, it undertakes this urban regeneration interventions, which help create additional public space to be privatized, but they also help by changing regulation to accommodate leisure industries. So to give you an example about this, on Aristotle Square, which is the central square of Thessaloniki, there used to be a limitation on the number of leisure industries which could be opened there, in order to protect the commercial character of this pedestrian street. Now, the municipal government gave about more licenses than it was allowed to. And when members of the public complained about this, the only thing that happened was that the regulation was changed. So now more land uses as leisure industries are allowed on that pedestrian street. Obviously, this has led to major problems in the quality of life of people, displacement pressures for residents, for other professionals, and so on. I can't go into that now, I don't have the time. And also, COVID-19 led to the situation becoming even worse, especially after the first lockdown, as the state government, provided emergency support to the hospitality sector, which included the doubling of the licensed outdoor public space to leisure industries, which was done free of charge. And despite the abolition of all other restrictions to indoor socializing, this is something that has been upheld and has been renewed until January 2023 now. So we have this increased occupation of public space by leisure industries, free of charge until January 2023. Okay, and to conclude then, I argue that the degree to which the commodification of public space is permitted influences the widening and even the creation of rent gaps. The less the common use of public space is respected, the higher the influence of public space on the rent gap. So public space provides, in practice, additional used space to leisure industry, which results in additional income for the local government. They get paid for the additional public space, for the public space that is used. Also income, additional income through rent to landlords, to commercial landlords, and of course additional income also to commercial tenants. So it's a win-win situation for all three categories there. And this in practice leads to a collaboration between state actors, landlords, and leisure entrepreneurs, which usually takes the form of urban regeneration interventions or tolerance of illegal activities. So we could say that the lack of enforcement of regulation, the tolerance and promotion of the privatization of public space can be seen as a discrete form of clientelism, as a calculated strategy by local governments accommodating leisure and tourism industries with higher echelons of state power, further promoting public space exploitation during the pandemic. So commercial gentrification is something that is a state-led strategy in the Greek context, and public space plays a key role in the increase of gentrification and touristification in this context. So that's all. Thank you.
Thanks, Philip. You touched upon many interesting things and many kind of pathologies, of course, of Greece, I would say, at last, but definitely of Thessaloniki, including the show about, you know, we're going to go and collect chairs and tables from the places where they, you know, they have illegal without license tables and stuff. So, but I mean, you know, there's more things that to think about, sort of corruption. So I know, even like anecdotally, that. It is very easy, you know, like to have an under the table payment, and you know the inspectors when they come sometimes they're open to receiving gifts, let's say. So it's much more pervasive and yeah, complex in sure, some way than the picture you presented. But also I think you showed, I think, you know, I don't, like, it didn't seem like that was the focus or part of the focus, but you also showed actual regeneration, you know, because if you know that series of pictures from the square that wasn't a square that then at the end got occupied by you know, tables and chairs, but you know, in a way I would still prefer that to how it was before. So in a way, regeneration nevertheless, so to speak. Anyway, so I have a couple of points I would like to raise, but I'd like to open it up to the audience. Please indicate your interest. Kira, you go first.
Great, thanks. I'm Kira from the Stuknomi on the European Institute. Thank you, Philip. I thought that was really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. I thought that your comment towards the end of the presentation about how kind of this kind of giving to this leisure industry this kind of extra ability to extract rent from its plot kind of drives the tourism-led growth model in Greece. I thought that's particularly kind of interesting. I am element of the institutional landscape, and I'm also interested in this kind of use, private use of public space, especially in the case of beaches. And I've also observed what Kevin was talking about, that it is astonishingly cheap to kind of use a public beach for the entire season. It costs, because you know, close to kind of where I spend my holidays, there's this beautiful beach that is used by this terrible beach bar every summer, and like, you know, actually, you know, there's illegal camping from the entirety of Europe, basically, right? So thousands of people come to camp in the forest, which is not allowed, and this bar, which has a license, sustains them, and it does many more things than it's actually allowed to do in its license. And that entire operation with hundreds of visitors every day, that costs less than 3K per year for the bar. So I'm wondering if that's a nuisance for the local residents and it decreases their quality of life, etc. Why are these fees so cheap? So like, why does nobody run locally saying, you know, we'll increase these fees and we'll decrease the extent of the phenomenon? So kind of what is the why do the businesses get their way and kind of the local residents feel so kind of powerless to react? And then the second question is, why is there no collective action kind of against, you know, this free-for-all? I mean, next to my kind of what I call kind of a private camping business running on public land, there's about 30 or 40 actual, you know, private camping businesses which pay for, you know, actually, you know, the place where the tents are, etc. So, and they don't seem to mind tremendously, right, that the other guy next door is doing exactly the same thing and is paying less than $3,000 a year. So, like, I'm wondering, what is it that stops also more established restaurants or restaurants in less privileged spots from reacting against the proliferation of the leisure industry everywhere? Because the incumbents would also have should have an incentive to mobilize. So anyway, I'm wondering, just a final point, sorry if I'm saying too many things, but I'm wondering if this business has started to become more concentrated and the firms start to become bigger and foreign, etc., if that might then increase the reaction against it. Yeah.
Sorry, if I can respond to that, then I'll take it.
Yeah, well, thank you for all of these points. Regarding the cost, I have no answer to that, why it is so cheap. I assume it has to do with the collaboration between leisure industries and the local state in this privatization of public space. I know for examples of some leisure industries, especially in not very, very good locations, like trendy spots, that they find the amount that they have to pay excessive, especially because they have to pay the amount throughout the year. They would have preferred it to be for a few months only. So there's the other side of the coin to that as well. For some businesses, it's still a big amount of money. It's a lot of money. But in general terms, you could say it is very, very cheap, especially in the hotspots where such major incomes can be made. Now, to your second point about the lack of resistance, this probably has to do with the comment that Vasilis made, so the last comment that he made. So he said that he prefers the way that looks now to what it was like before. So of course it is some sort of improvement of local space. And of course, most people, especially I guess in a society like in Greece, for the locals, but for the tourists as well, they like this coffee culture. So they like sitting in public space and being able to consume at the same time. It is hard to imagine oneself just sitting on a bench nowadays, right? It's not an activity that most people would do anymore. It seems that we have been domesticated in this idea that a coffee culture has to do in the Greek context with sitting at these tables and chairs. So there's not such a general reaction against the privatization public space as such, especially in the case of Thessaloniki. There are some citizen initiatives, but they're mostly against the transgressions that happen, so the illegal occupation of public space. They do support the legal occupation. They, of course, they also have issues with noise pollution or with antisocial behavior, with the litter, or with all of these other issues. But their main concern has to do with these transgressions, with the illegal businesses. So what they're trying to do is to enforce the regulation, basically, in practice. Of course, this is something that has been turned upside down because of the COVID-related regulations. But that's the main point. Now, regarding the concentration of businesses, there's this issue that not many multinational chains or corporations have managed to get into the leisure industry market in Greece. There's been huge problems even for giants like McDonald's or Starbucks getting into the Greek market. It seems that very localized stores or some national chains are more active and more successful in their business strategies. But looking at the case of Thessaloniki and this leisure industries, especially in popular leisure epicenters, in places where people go out a lot, yes, there has been a concentration of businesses. So there is a direction towards people owning 10 or 20 bars or businesses and so on. So yes, there's been an increase in concentration there. This has not resulted into any additional resistance or complaints against them. They rather have more power to work together with the state and be able to actively defend their claims to the use of public space.
There's a question there, and if they relate, we'll take them together, otherwise.
Thank you for your presentation. My name is Antonella Bruzzese. I'm Italian. I'm working at the Politecnico di Milano, and I studied a similar case in three cities of Italy, Milano, Bologna, and Bari, especially related to the occupation of public space free of charge after COVID and their effect. I'm an urban planner and urban designer, so my point of view was to observe the effect in the public space of this occupation. And I found very interesting your point of view that is reflecting especially on the revenues and the economic impact. And my question is similar to the previous one, because I was wondering which kind of conflict, because this occupation and concentration of this occupation happened. Because in the cases I have in mind, in Italy, there were a lot of conflict, especially with the residents and the concentration, because you know, bars and restaurants and generally, you know, comida produce noise and not only revenues. And the second question is, I'm wondering if in these cities there is a sort of planning of the occupation, because not for the free of charge after the COVID, but from the regular one. In some cities, for instance, in Bologna, they had the public administration try to make some plan in organizing the concentration of the occupation of public space in order to grant the walkability, the not excessive concentration. So I was wondering if you have any hint about it. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, I think yes.
Yeah, regarding the first point, there's the issue that the increase in the number of leisure industries, the increase in the number of the use of public, the amount of public space that is used by leisure industries, were also accompanied by increased tourism in the city, and increased tourism also going into short-term rentals. Now, most of the short-term rentals in Saloniki are located in the city center. In the city center of the city, Saloniki has been losing population during the last decades. So there's been a depopulation going on. So there is noise pollution, there are these nuisances, but there are not that many people to form a coalition against these nuisances. So the population has been decreasing. Of course, these leather industries are also located in specific areas. There is sometimes epicenters of leather industries, like La Lavica or the Frankish Quarter, which are non-residential areas. So there, the nuisances mainly affect other professional, other commercial users. But these are users of industries or of light industries which are in a bad economic situation and would sooner or later close anyway. So again, they don't have much leverage to provide some resistance to that process. Regarding your second question, it has to do, yes, there is a plan on how to occupy public space, which public space can be occupied by leisure industries. This is usually the space in front of the shop fronts. So only that they can occupy. But of course, I was sure there are illegal activities of expanding up, further than that. But the regulation is that they can only occupy the space that is in front of the shop front, both in squares and in sidewalks. So they're not allowed to occupy legally the space of the store next doors if this is another use. Unless, of course, the other commercial use allows them to do so.
Okay, there was a question from Kevin, or
should I take your question?
Yeah, just, I'm also Italian, I'm Francesco from LSC Cities, working with Antonella at LSC Cities. I have some points, because I think our cases are similar. I come from Naples, which is in some ways a similar case as Thessaloniki, a city that is somehow economically, or was for some time, underdeveloped, still is, and sees tourists as a as a recipe for economic success, sometimes too much in my opinion, there's an over reliance, you know, on these industries. I noted down on why there's no opposition to this kind of, you know, imbalance. Because I'm also involved somehow in politics in my town, I see exactly that people prefer to see some kind of activity to no activity, but also from my perspective, because I've been around in Europe and I've lived in some cities, because they don't know the alternative. There's no free alternative. There's no, for instance, I'm the one who suffers the most because there's no, I don't know, public library or public plaza or public beach, you know? They know, this is something that needs to be paid because there is just no alternative. And as you said, completely second the fact that these economic powers become more and more powerful and they play a greater and greater role also in politics. So it becomes very difficult to oppose that. And then I noted down something in your presentation that I think is very interesting and at the same time dangerous, the fact that while this sector has been stable, the number of empty shops at the ground level has been rising. This means that these empty shops can be attacked by these extractive industries. And because I also monitor cities for my project, I read about Barcelona, the city is buying up these closed street level spaces exactly to do this. To preserve it from tourists. The other city who's doing this is Amsterdam, and these are two cities that you mentioned as being particularly impacted by over-tourism. And what they're doing is basically buying these spaces before they get leased by shops or by, I don't know, Kiko for makeup or, you know, these kind of things that only serve tourists. But it's very something that at the moment only big cities are able to.
Yeah, this is something that would not be possible in the Greek context. Like maybe the mayor of Athens suggested some ideas going into that direction, but it's something that is difficult to implement given the economic state of Greek cities and their high reliance on state funding. So it's something that would not be able to do. The thing is though that in the case of Thessaloniki, because it's tourism industry is not as developed as Barcelona or Amsterdam or Rome or Venice or all of these major cities. There is, you could say, limits to the carrying capacity of how many leisure industries could open in the city. So there's a high fluctuation already of leisure industries opening, lasting a few months, because it's a labor-intensive industry, so you don't need a lot of capital to invest. You can try starting one and then close again. So there's no real threat at the moment, I believe, of all of the shops being turned into leisure industries. The problem is that there's no real alternative for them being empty either. So we have these monocultures of leisure industries, but no real alternative to them, or to the empty shops.
Yes.
Yeah,
hi, my name is Amiroz Bahais, I'm a fellow at the law school, but more importantly, I lived in the Solomon Islands for 10 years. I've seen this thing and I get this. And my question or comment might go a bit further away from what you're saying, but I was wondering how this your thesis interacts with the issue of like residential gentrification.
Yeah.
In the sense that, you know, Ladavika and Pragomahalas, they are basically composed of high rises, right? But to me at least, to my inexpert eye, it seems that they are not really well exploited. Like there are some bars that stretch for four or five semi-empty floors.
Yep.
And I was wondering whether, you know, kind of like this privatization of public space basically keeps residential gentrification at bay, which might be good from some point of view or not, and whether as kind of an enforcement mechanism in order to combat this phenomenon, we could try and increase the residential use of those areas in order to kind of create this kind of private enforcers that would have an incentive to try and shut this down, and whether there could be an effort to that.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's also very, very important and relevant. So there have been some attempts of using these places also for residential uses, turning empty former light industries into lofts, into homes for people. And especially in the case of the Frankish Quarter of Fragon Mahalas that you mentioned, in the late 2000s, early 2010s, there was a lot of tension between residential gentrifiers, people of a higher socioeconomic background, artists, architects, who wanted to move into these kind of buildings and the aesthetics, and leisure industries. They didn't have much power at the time, so a lot of these people moved out again because they couldn't bear the noise pollution. And since leisure industries became more prevalent, especially in Fragon Mahalas, this has changed dramatically because there's a lot of economic power behind leisure industries as well, and a kind of residential use for leisure industries. So a lot of bars on Valauritu and Sigru streets, which were the main streets on which these leisure industries were located at the beginning, have closed or have had issues with noise pollution and controls over noise pollution. And this has to do with this change and the increase in residential uses in the area. So yes, there has been this attempt to use areas for housing as well, both for short-term rentals and for medium-term rentals. So I know of several buildings in Fragon Mahalas which have been bought up by investors, European, Israeli, Chinese, also Greek, who have renovated entire floors or entire buildings and are renting them out on Airbnb or on the medium term for a year or so to what's the word? Digital nomads. Okay, that's it. So there is definitely the potential there for these uses as well.
Okay, I'll do the
I have a brief one actually. Having in mind those areas you just mentioned and being those areas that might mainly affected by this transformation, has there been any change in the demographics of the residential population in this area? And if yes or not, would that be related to the non-collective action against, you know, these developments and changes extending to noise, whatever, blah, 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 and having in mind what you mentioned about people being willing to accept the changes because they're part of this lifestyle.
Yeah. It's hard really to tell about residential change because the last census in Greece was kind of a fiasco in many ways, so they were not very successful in getting all the data that they needed about the residential population. It hasn't been released yet as well, so it's hard to tell on the larger scale about residential changes. From interviews that I've done and from people I've talked to, including real estate agents, there have been, and my research also on leisure, on short-term rentals, yes, there have been changes. So a lot of the empty parts of the city center have now been occupied by leisure industries, especially on the western part of the city center, so the Frankish Quarter, overlap Ptolemaeon and that area. And so there's a lot of leisure industries there, but also short-term rentals, also new hotels. So the population there is rather the tourists that have gotten into this area. Then there has been this claim, which I have not been able to really assess, by many people, including real estate agents, that there's been a return of population to the city center, of more affluent people who lived in the suburbs, but during the economic crisis decided to move back to the homes that they own in the city center.
What about students and this kind of...
Students are still occupying a large part of, especially the eastern part of the center. But, of course, due to short-term rentals, there's also been pressure on rents of traditionally student housing. So small studio flats or one-bedroom flats, which have now competition and the rent increases. So we've also seen the proliferation now of new privately owned, privately run student halls. So there's quite a few new student halls which have opened in different parts of the city. But yeah, as I said, I can't really say much more about the larger picture of residential change.
Just one final to end this. So do you think that lack of ownership, or to put it in a better terms, like a non-occupation of homeowners to the flats that they own in that area leads to the lack of collective action against this?
So in another way, is it like an indirect way of the owners of the area to lead to the short-term residential occupation of these premises, so there's no collective reaction? So everybody that's been living and they own the house and they've been for many years, they've just, you know, gentrified, thrown away, so there's no really nothing to be done against it, because the...
Yeah, that's, you know, this is a point that makes sense, sure. I mean, it makes sense that a lot of the housing in this area is occupied by people like tourists, or by short-term migrants, or by just tenants who don't really care about the area and might leave, perhaps. So there could be this as well as a reason of why there's no collective action in the area, but and the truth is that the city center of Thessaloniki, the owner occupation is at about 55%, when the state, the number across Greece is 78%, 77% still, so it's much lower than the national average. So this could potentially play a role in it, but I haven't really looked into that direction. I can't say more about it.
Thanks.
Thank you. Kevin.
Thanks, Philip. Fascinating study. What's the political science approach here? I wonder what scope there might be. I was struck by what you were saying about a particular sector, increasing coffee shop consumption from the 1980s onwards, etc., and still a largely closed domestic market, modest incursion by foreign companies. It's the lived experience of the local state. It isn't the only sector, however, in which we might refer to the regulatory weakness of the local state, or indeed of clientelistic politics. And I just wonder, over time, whether the data exists to be able to show, for the last 4 or 5 decades, for example, the fee level which is being charged in this particular sector, and across different municipalities. So that potentially could be related to the nature of the political leadership and political interest, etc. But again, I do thought that there must be other sectors in which one could chart long-term data on regulatory fees and a comparison between the fee level for the use of public space by private companies, e.g. coffee shops, in comparison to regulatory fees in other areas, could actually reinforce the point that this is a sector in which public interest has been greatly abused. I just want, it's more of an inquiry as to whether there is the potential to get data which would allow you to compare the sector across the country, but also across time, and whether this might be then used as an indicator of the weak local regulatory state and how exceptional this particular sector might be or not.
Yeah, thank you again for the point that you made about the fees, and also during the presentation. I mean, this is something that I haven't thought more about. So there's certainly the potential for doing that. As you know, digitalization of this information is very, very slow in Greece, so I would have to go back to the municipal government, to the local government, and see if they have these figures still in their archives. But it's definitely doable, and I think that, yeah, this longer-term perspective would provide probably confirmation of this hypothesis about the way in which this specific sector, the leisure industries, has managed to abuse or collaborate with state power.
It would just be fascinating whether the real terms increase is exceptionally low in this particular sector, as opposed to other fees being charged by the local states over time. Does that reinforce the argument we wish to make about the private abuse of public space.
Very short pointed for the features, you can get it in the
Appian. You
can get it in the Appian, the digital transparency system. Oh, right. It's extremely hard, and you have to really kind of suffer, but it's there. And it's
but only the ones after 2010. Mm-hmm. Only the ones after 2010.
Right.
That's historical, but I don't know.
Can I ask my question? I have a question, but I'm just doing the maths of the... So let's say a table for four in the cafeteria in the taverna would take 3 square meters, I'm thinking big people like me, so you need a bit of space. So in the Nikis or whatever, that would be 9,000 a year for a table. No?
Are you looking to reduce the bill you pay?
No, I'm just saying 300
it
euros.
900.
Yes. Okay. Okay. 900 per table. Okay. So if you're a cafeteria, then I mean, you know, like, and you want to allocate, I don't know, 10% of your profit margin to the table because you also pay for salaries and other things. I mean, you know, how many thousand of euros per table that you make a year? I don't know. I mean, you know, in the very successful place where people are keen to get a seat, maybe that's a joke money. But in some businesses, it may not be that. So I'm not quite sure how super cheap that is. I mean, you know, you say £3,000 for a beat, sounds very cheap, you know. But I mean, you know, if somebody has like 20 tables out and they pay 10,000 euros, I don't know how much compares to the indoor rental area.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's not my question. So you can, the question is, the city of Thessaloniki, to my knowledge, has been quite successful in protecting some specific spaces, including the Nea Paralia, where there's no, I mean, you know, it could have easily been turned into a sea of tables and chairs. But I mean, okay, obviously you have a lot of space, but even. You know, like the development of the new Nea Paralia also used, so converted not public space into public space with all these kind of gardens and stuff. And still you have private provision of leisure, you know, leisure businesses, although these tend to be much more kind of a bit more expensive or catering for, you know, medium to higher incomes, so to speak. So basically the question is this something which is very specific to the particular geography of the inner of a city center, which is like not very, but you know, quite narrow pavements and, I mean, okay, depopulation I take it, but very high density of housing. And generally speaking, apart from some parts of the city center, medium to low incomes, you know, definitely, at least, yeah, as parts of the city center. So is the over exploitation, you know, overuse of the public space, some feature, you know, so related to some natural feature of the place, rather than sort of, you know, policy or the, you know, because we're saying, okay, the municipalities regenerate, like, you know, always produce public space in order to sell it.
Yeah.
But then if you think, okay, they produced public space in Nea Paralia and they didn't sell it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Nea Paralia has a specific regulation where they're not allowed. And this is to operate public to private as public space, and this is something that's been enforced there so far. So it hasn't been the case that there you have the privatization or legal use of public space. But I wouldn't say that this is something that is just happening in the city center of Thessaloniki. I mean, if you go to any city or village in Greece, you will see this legal privatization and commodification of public space taking place. Of course, it might be to a smaller degree in other parts of the city because they don't have the same clientele in these leisure industries, tourists and the locals. We know that Thessaloniki is a very monocentric city, so a lot of people from other suburbs, other areas, go out the city center as well. So, yeah, you wouldn't see it to the same extent in Neapoli or Sikes or these districts, but still, in some parts of these areas where there's the hotspots of the cafes and the restaurants, it's still happening. So it's not a thing that is particular to Thessaloniki, it's the clientelism is a more embedded into the national way in which politics is sort of operates in the new context, I would say. Regarding the first point that you made, though, about this charge being low, we should not forget that, of course, they pay this charge for the occupation of public space, but in many occasions, the owners of the commercial property where this is located also incorporate this additional charge into the rent. So that people would have to pay a premium in order to locate in the seafront anyway. So the rent will be much higher as well.
But if I may, I would never venture in this argument for having less, giving up less space to for commercial purposes, because the opposition is clearly from the business owners, whereas talking about at least granting access to the public, so to the people, is probably a better argument for having to grant, let's say, the rights that the laws defend.
Yeah.
Every time there is an argument, they pay too little. Indeed, what you said is true. They start, you know, mentioning, listing their expenses to say, oh, no, it's actually not that cheap. But the point is also that the space is not there anymore for the public.
Sure, yeah. Strategically, if you want to do something,
I wouldn't have.
It's not the strategy to follow, yes.
I mean, okay, so there's two things here, yeah? Because one is, sorry, we have a bit of time, so one thing is in cases where really access to the public is restricted, so, you know, if you think about sort of Filippo and stuff in Olimbu, in kind of the upper part of the, yeah, where, yeah, more students are also located, then there are pavements where you just cannot go through, you have to go down the street, you have to navigate through parked cars, so if you have a buggy, it's impossible, you know, you just stay there until tomorrow. But there are other places like Iktin where you can see that there's excessive use of tables and stuff, but access in itself is not a problem. So, you know, you can still drive a vehicle down Iktin and on the other side. So it is not only access, it is also the change in character and the use of the place and whether that, you know, sort of what you're saying, allows the development of you know, sort of other commercial activities, or what it does to the housing or the residential use of the space.
Yeah.
Is there any difference between the sort of, like, have you seen in the interviews different patterns of answers or different types of engagement for when you were talking about these kind of bigger areas where access in itself is not really a problem, but they become a bit more of a poly supermarket type of thing versus the more local ones?
I wouldn't say so, because this exploitation of public space has been happening at a large scale. There's always the incentive to use as much as more as you can. You mentioned Iktinu.
Yeah.
So this photograph here is from Iktinu,
yeah.
About the illegal occupation of public space. So it's something.
Yeah, but they could fit a truck. You know, I mean, access was not
a problem. Because there's 3.5 meters right away to the open pedestrian street. But here they were occupying space which was in the shop front of another building, not their own.
Sure.
Yeah, there is some regulation which is usually upheld, and not always with the same success.
Yeah.
But it's something that is happening throughout the city. I wouldn't say that it's hard more in the smaller, narrow streets, more than the bigger pedestrian areas.
Building to what Vasilis said, just a quick one. So, if this development would bring further pedestrianization of the streets in the city center, although it increases rent and it increases the exploitation, you know, but still people can drive the bike in, so, you know, people are happy, so there is use of proper public use.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that people would support it and would be okay with that? So, you know, as long as it doesn't affect me the way I work in the street and there's no cars, you know, you can exploit as much as you want and I'm happy with it.
Yeah.
So is this kind of attitude generally, do you think?
Sorry, before, may I add just a comment because it's related to this?
Mm-hmm.
I know, for instance, in another Italian cities, a situation in which the opposition to the pedestrianization of some street arise from the small shop owner, because they are afraid of what you call the commercial gentrification, because the rise of the rent now push for big companies, and they are, so there is also different kind of opposition and situations.
Mm-hmm. No, this is true, and I was going to refer to this. It's also a class issue there. So you might argue that some people would support pedestrianization, but of course there's also a lot of opposition against it because people want to use their private cars, and they want to use them in the city center and park in the city center and so on. So yeah, this is not something that is uncontested. And the major pedestrianization in Hagia Sophia's, it was not completed because of a church that is located there. And the church, the Greek Orthodox Church, was against the pedestrianization because they wanted to be able to drive with their cars up to enter from the church. So you have these issues which complicate the situation. Of course, small shop owners are also against, because they fear commercial gentrification, the increase in rents that pedestrianization might bring. Local inhabitants might be against it because they won't be able to park their cars under the houses anymore, they won't have to pay for a car park. So yeah, this is a more complicated issue there.
Okay, I think we could continue the discussion for a long time, but we have to vacate this room. Before I ask you to join me in thanking Philip for the presentation, may I say that we may continue the conversation over the pint at the White House, so if other people want to join, please feel free to join us. On this note, I don't know exactly when the next HSO seminar is, but the main big thing that is happening is next Monday we have the Prime Minister of Greece coming to speak. The event has been moved slightly to 7:30, I believe. More information on our website. So on that note, Philip, thank you very much for the presentation.